Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Mark Middaugh, and I'm arguing on behalf of the appellant Munir Walji. This Court should reverse Mr. Walji's convictions because they were indelibly tainted by prosecutorial misconduct in the form of bolstering testimony and vouching during closing argument.
Well, really, aren't we here on your motion for a new trial?
Your Honor, I did file a motion for a new trial, and I raised additional grounds in the appellate's brief.
Right. But I thought what we were here for, really, was that you felt like the new trial ought to have been granted, and it wasn't. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. But in United States versus Combs, which was the only case I could find where a new trial motion for prosecutorial vouching or bolstering was denied in a new trial motion, and then it went up on appeal, this panel or this court did not draw any distinction between the appellate review of the denial of a new trial motion and a simple appeal based on vouching.
Well, the trouble that I have is that I'm looking now at what standard of review I use in this particular situation. And it seemed to me that you argued to the district court that it was standard of review would be plain error review. And that seems to me it would be plain error review here. And I'm just trying to make sure we're on the same wavelength about that.
Your Honor, I'm not conceding that plain error review is appropriate.
Isn't that what you said to the district court?
Yes, Your Honor.
That it would be plain error review?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then why? I mean, if you told the district court that, why are you not saying it now?
Your Honor, I think that there's a difference when a
What's the difference? I mean, you said, and I quote, although raising a contemporaneous objection to vouching or bolstering is preferred, this form of prosecutorial misconduct is such a serious issue, has often been said to be plain error.
Yes, Your Honor.
Reviewable even though no objection was raised. So it seemed to me what you were saying is you got plain error review here, Judge.
And Your Honor, on appeal, I think that the government is now taking the position that there's this double deference, that the court has to find that there's an abuse of discretion of the trial court applying the plain error review.
And well, I guess I'm trying to figure out, and this is quite important to me, having been in the trial court all my life, pretty important to me that if you're not going to say this is plain error review, I'm wondering if you forfeited any argument that it isn't, because you didn't make it below, you didn't make it to me, and that's where I am.
I understand that, Your Honor. Assuming that we're on plain error review.
Okay.
This court has repeatedly found that vouching is serious enough to justify reversal under that standard. What I would take issue with the government's argument on is that they're saying because there was a new trial motion, any issue not raised in the new trial motion was forfeited for appeal, which they don't cite any relevant case law for that. And second, they say, well, there's double deference because you're now having to look for abuse of discretion on the plain error standard of review. And the only case that the government cites for that proposition is an AEDPA case. And obviously, AEDPA is not applicable in the context of a federal appeal. And it would undermine the purpose of new trial motions if you said, well, if you file a new trial motion on a tight timeline, sometimes without the benefit of transcripts, you forfeit any issue not raised on appeal. That would discourage litigants from raising appropriate claims.
Well, let's look to plain error review then. If we look to plain error review, did you ever move to limit or exclude the testimony of the interviewer?
I was not the trial counsel, Your Honor.
Did they ever?
They did not, Your Honor.
So if they didn't ever move to limit or exclude the testimony, that makes it even harder for your argument, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I disagree with that. And the trial court—
I'm not saying that's the way I said, doesn't it make it more difficult for you?
I mean, given
the case law, if you'd made a motion to limit or exclude, then we would have a little bit different situation in front of us. We might have— is it an evidentiary problem or something like that? But we don't, because nobody made that objection.
Yes, well, that puts us on plain error review.
Well, makes us on plain error review as to a motion for a new trial as it relates to whether we have vouching or not. That's the case law.
Yes, Your Honor, but again, this court has repeatedly found that when prosecutorial vouching occurs, when bolstering testimony is sponsored, that that's an error that can justify reversal regardless of whether there was a defense objection. And I think that the logic that the district court employed was, well, because there was no objection, it must not have been important. And I think that that was kind of an impermissible double counting of the lack of objection, because the whole point of plain error review is you apply a higher standard when the trial counsel makes a mistake, doesn't catch an error. But then to say, well, they made a mistake, so it wasn't important, I don't believe that that's an appropriate logic, and I don't believe that that's supported by this court's case law.
I'm wondering if the way you just phrased the vouching issue is a bit oversimplified, because, you know, I don't even know if there is vouching. I don't know if I agree with the district judge here that there was vouching, so to speak. Can you tell me why having a witness such as, I think her name is Ms. Strom, is that right?
Yes.
Like what really is it about her very limited testimony that trial counsel for Mr. Walshy engaged with and used, I think, and the prosecutor trying to bolster credibility with the arguments that she made and closings, like how is that really vouching? Other than, and I'm sorry to try to, because for example, trial counsel for the defendant, he engaged in quite a bit of credibility attacks, and in fact, almost went so far as to call a witness a racist in his closing argument. So why could the defense counsel take full advantage of credibility when the prosecutor can't?
Everything about this statement was inadmissible hearsay. No one is disputing that this statement was inadmissible hearsay from the outset.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was not brief testimony. This was 22 transcript pages. And you could use this to teach a trial advocacy class on how to qualify an expert. Give me your post-secondary education. Give me your training. Is just anyone allowed to do this job? Are other people present? Yes, there are FBI agents. All to bolster the credibility of inadmissible hearsay. And there are two kinds of vouching. And I think that's really important to understand that there's one form of explicit vouching where the prosecutor says, I think, I believe, or says something about government witnesses necessarily being more credible due to their position as government witnesses. That is not at issue here. But there's a strong implication that the government has access to material that the jury is not allowed to see, and that fostered their decision, that promoted their decision to bring those charges. And they're telling the jury, we had an unbiased expert.
I'm not trying to interrupt you. Go ahead. Judge D'Alba, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. Thank you. Thank you, Judge Smith. Counsel, tell me then, I mean, if we're on plain error review, how were Mr. Walshy's substantial rights seriously affected?
This was a case where credibility was paramount, and the district court recognized that this was fundamentally a tale of two witnesses. Mr. Walshy gave multiple statements where he denied that this occurred, including to the police, and the jury didn't get to hear any of that. But this be under the guise of investigative process, the government is allowed to say, well, this witness went, and she gave an hour-long statement, and guess what? Ms. Strom, the unbiased person who's not a part of the investigation, essentially thought that she was credible, could tell fact from fiction. The FBI agent who watched it on a TV screen, well, that guy certainly thought that she was credible. And the U.S. attorney who got a copy of it and gave it to Ms. Strom to watch directly before she got on the stand, well, that just reinforced their decision to pursue this trial. And that is exactly what Cunningham and Brooks say you can't do. You can't go into that investigative process and imply to the jury that there's extra record evidence that they're not hearing that has convinced everybody else that the defendant is guilty.
Let's go back.
Sorry.
You're on your way. Go ahead.
weren't there instructions given, though, then for the forensic interview? And didn't the district court also instruct the jury to only consider the evidence actually before it? So tell me why that doesn't impact your analysis here.
You're giving standard jury instructions that discuss the duty of jurors in terms of what they're allowed to consider and what their job is as jurors does not cure the specific prejudice. And I understand that's one of the issues on plain error review is that there's no opportunity for the judge to address the issue and give the appropriate curative instruction. But when you combine that with the closing argument where the prosecutor incorrectly implied to the jury that this statement, which was inadmissible, was consistent with her trial testimony, that was very significant prejudice. So,
well, but just a minute, the prosecutor didn't say that. Prosecutor also said, I want to highlight from Mr. Rusk's closing when he talked to you about what was said by Gabby in her statement in the child forensic interview. You heard no evidence about that because that's hearsay. That's what he said right then. He also said, members of the jury, you, not any witness or the government, decide what testimony is credible and what testimony is not credible. That's what he said in his final argument. So I'm trying to figure out, he was saying, don't say anything I said was not something you need to look at. Anything any other witness for the government said is not something you ought to look at. What I want you to do is you have to decide it. And that's what he was trying to say.
Your Honor, the first statement, I believe, compounds the prejudice because what they're saying is you didn't hear that. Ms. Strom did, the FBI did, we did, but you don't. So I think it only serves to highlight and draw into starker relief the fact that there is this extrajudicial evidence that they did not hear. With respect to the second argument, a prosecutor's argument or correct statement of the law, I did not see any case law as I was researching this that says that because the prosecutor made some type of accurate statement of the law, that it cures any vouching that occurred during their...
frankly, you didn't find any case law that says that this plain error either. The bottom line is you've got to find out what happened here, and is it plain error? And that's why I emphasized the standard of review.
Yes, Your Honor, and for all the reasons that are outlined in my brief and the reply brief, I do believe that this was plain error. I do believe that the district court got it right, that there was vouching and bolstering, and I do believe her logic that this did not affect Mr. Walgie's substantial rights understated the prejudice to him that came from this testimony.
Counsel, you are over your time. I will give you your full 2 minutes for rebuttal because we were the ones who put you over time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. And now we're going to hear from Ms. Culbertson. And I hope I pronounced that correctly as well.
You did, Your Honor. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Tanya Culbertson on behalf of the United States. The district court correctly denied Mr. Walgie's new trial motion based on his forfeited vouching claims. And I think as your honors recognize, we are looking at the entirety of the record here. Reviewed in the full context, the district court correctly concluded that any errors here, if indeed there were errors, which of course in our brief we are not necessarily conceding, they did not seriously affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceedings. And that is because in no small part because of the evidence of Mr. Walgie's DNA on the crotch of MV1's pants, the testimony by MV1 and her mother, MV1's immediate and consistent reporting on the airplane, both to her mother and to the flight attendants, and MV1's evident emotional state when she spoke with her mother, when she spoke to the flight attendants, and when she spoke with law enforcement on the ground. So that is all powerful evidence. Obviously, MV1's credibility is relevant to the district or to the jury's determination, but that this is not a case like Alcantara Castillo, where you really just have the defendant testifying that he didn't know he was illegally crossing into the United States, and you have the agent sort of testifying why he thought this person did, and that's really all you have here.
And if you get that far, or if we get that far, I think what Mr. Middaugh said earlier, the way he characterized it, is it really is a credibility test between the victim and the defendant. And so what other than the DNA evidence is there to substantiate the victim's version of events?
Well, you have both substantiating the victim's versions of events and undercutting Mr. Walgie's version of events. So you have her mother saying, yes, this is what she told me. You have her mother and the flight attendant saying she told them the same things immediately afterwards. You have also just her physical emotional reaction on the airplane, which was obvious to everyone and not contested. And then you have the things that undercut Mr. Walgie's credibility, that, you know, his behavior on the plane in terms of, you know, as the plane was landing, getting up, going back to the back of the plane, you know, trying to get to the front, is corroborated by the other witnesses. And yet, you know, he denies it when he, or denies some of that when he is himself testifying. So I think you look at all of those things taken together, and I really don't want to minimize the importance of the DNA evidence here too. I mean, that is very strong evidence that we don't always or even often have in a case like this. So I think that the district court, you know, looking at this on a totality under the plain error standard, was right to conclude that his substantial rights were not violated, and that this did not seriously affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceedings.
Judge Smith.
Go ahead.
I'll let you finish this.
No, you're up. You're the one far away on camera. Go for it.
All right. Counsel, you were mentioning the importance of the DNA evidence. That sat a little uncomfortable with me, given that, and, you know, if I got this wrong, please let me know. But wasn't the DNA evidence simply on the outside of her clothing, not on the inside? And wasn't the allegation that he actually placed his hand inside of her pants and her underwear?
So that's right. There are two counts. And so count number two is for touching MV1's crotch through an inner thigh and crotch through her pants. And so that is, you know, the DNA, of course, is highly, highly relevant to that. The first count is the touching under the clothing, or the attempted touching of the genitalia under the clothing. I do think the DNA evidence is relevant to that. Agreed, there's no DNA recovered from, or Mr. Walgie's DNA is not recovered from inside her underwear, but you do have testimony from the DNA examiner explaining why that might be, why touch DNA might not be left by a very quick touch. And I do still think that the fact that DNA is found in that region, the exterior region of that pants, is relevant to him touching her clothing, touching her pants, pulling them up, putting his hand under. But for sure, you do have to rely also on the credibility of the victim as to that first count. I know that my friend on the other side and with Judge Smith talked a little bit about, you know, the importance of the testimony of the child forensic examiner. And I do think what really distinguishes this case from any of the cases cited by Mr. Middaugh is the fact that during rebuttal, the government's rebuttal, the last thing that the jury hears from the government is, you can't consider anything that was said. That was hearsay. You can't consider what was said in that interview. And that is, as the district court recognized, that really, differentiates and takes some of the wind out of the sails in terms of any prejudice from, you know, I think the prosecutor was careful in her parsing when she's discussing consistency. It's clear that she is saying MV1 was very consistent in remarks to the mother and then to the flight attendants. That is where there are no details different. She then goes on to make the accurate statement. You also heard that she gave a statement at Alaska Cares and to the Port of Seattle. She does not say then anything about those statements were also consistent. That clearly would have been vouching. So again, we take issue with the conclusion that you can vouch simply by listing or describing true evidence, you know, evidence that actually came before the jury. Unless the court has questions about any of the other allegations of vouching or anything else in the case, we would ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you very much.
Mr. Middle, you may approach again for your rebuttal.
Thank you for the additional time, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
With respect to the DNA evidence, not only is it problematic that no DNA was found inside the complainant's pants, there was also a third unknown contributor who contributed almost as much DNA to the DNA sample as Mr. Walji. So if Mr. Walji was rubbing this young woman's pants for 90 minutes, then someone else must have been as well, or this was inadvertent transfer that can occur, as the DNA examiner testified, through all different kinds of ways, being in close proximity with a third party. With respect to the closing argument misconduct, the prosecutor made a conscious decision to divide her closing argument about credibility into three sections: consistency, corroboration, and motive to lie. She made a conscious choice to put the Alaska Cares or Child First statement in the section on consistency. She could, in the government's response to the new trial motion and on appeal, they said, well, this is really just about her motive to lie. It's really just about the procedural steps. But that is not how that statement was used during closing. It was used to imply that the statement was consistent with all of the other statements, and that is decidedly improper. This court should reverse the convictions and remand for a new trial that is not tainted by vouching during closing and bolstering testimony of Ms. Strong.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. And I would like to thank both counsel for their excellent arguments this morning. This matter is now submitted.